Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. I just wanted to say a few welcoming remarks. So this is actually an event that straddles two conferences. One is on LSE Environment Camp, which is targeted at PhD students studying environmental economics from all over the world. And the other is the LSE Sustainable Growth Conference, which brings in policymakers and academics from India. And I think what's interesting about that sort of putting those two together is we have the very young people who are increasingly filling the academic sort of ranks studying environmental economics. And that part is what's been going on today. We'll take part for half of tomorrow, and then we move into the India conference half of Friday and then Saturday. What's interesting about that is we're basically seeing this movement of lots of young researchers getting interested in the environment, but in part that's driven by the demand of policymakers from India and many other places, which are sort of driving up that demand. And we're seeing that sort of demand for environmental economics across not just academia, but policy firms and so on. So it's exciting to kind of combine those two things in this event. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce my colleague, Oriana Bandiera, who will chair the event. But thank you very much for coming.
Doesn't seem like... Okay, now it is. Hello. My name is Oriana Bandiera. I'm the Sir Anthony Atkinson Professor of Economics here at the LSE, and I'm delighted to welcome you to this event. There's a few things that I need to say before we get started. They're all printed here, so I will read them carefully. The first is that we're being live streamed and recorded, and all of this will be made available subject to there being no technical difficulties. You assess the probability of that happening. We are at the LSE. There will be time at the end of the talks to ask questions. So please wait till then. And we will also be able to have questions from the online audience. So online audience, if you have a way to disrupt us now, please don't. When you ask questions, I will ask you and I will remind you to say your name, your full affiliation, and to keep the question brief and to the point. For those in the room, please switch off your phones or put them on silent. It's a bit more bearable. You don't have to separate yourself from your phone. I understand that that's hard. And for those on social media, you can contribute to the conversation online by using hashtag LSEECamp. Okay, that's the housekeeping done. So now we're going to talk about climate inequality from evidence to practical action. Okay? We will run for a total of 80 minutes. Will be 40 minutes, I think 50 minutes talks, and the rest questions. So please join me in welcoming our fantastic guests. They need very little introduction, so I will be very brief. We have Esther Duflo, with long titles and an even longer bio. You all know her. You're here to listen to her, so I will not say any more. Other than, welcome to Shweta Banerjee, who's the head of BRAC International. And if you don't know who BRAC is, by the end of tonight you will, and you will be very impressed, as I was when I first found out about 20 years ago. So now, without further ado, Esther, take it away.
Good evening, good evening. Thank you for being here. Much of what I'm going to say might be old news, so I will, I'll apologize for that. But it's something that has been useful for me to put together. So different strands of work that I find complement each other well, some of them having to do with climate, some having to do with taxation efforts. So when you talk about climate change, Per Crochet was reminding us this afternoon that there is a big impact of the past. The stock of carbon is what determines the impact on the climate, the future warming. So we are pretty prompt to recognize our past responsibility, we being sort of the Western part of the world, pretty prompt to recognize our past responsibility with climate, but often the next sentence is, oh, but now, of course, there is China and India, not very far behind. So really, we should not be thinking about the problem of inequality of climate change in the present term, because everyone is coming right down the hills of the rest of us. And of course, it's true. This is what it is. But one thing that we forget in this calculation is that a lot of the carbon that is being emitted from China is emitted in the service of consumption that we that is performed in Europe or in the U.S. So, if you use trade tables, and you're looking at the type of goods that get imported and where, and the type of goods that gets exported and where, to get a full notion of the carbon footprint of a country, you need to really account for trade as well. And some countries are massive CO2 exporters, like China, India to a large extent, and the US is a huge importer of carbon, so is Europe. So we need to take that into account. And even more than that, we also need to take into account the fact that even inside, within countries, if you take out India, for example, the carbon footprint of India is not equally contributed by all of the citizens of India. There is enormous amount of within-country inequality in carbon footprint, both in poor countries and in rich countries. And in fact, over time, as countries become more unequal and as middle-income countries are growing, the contribution of within-country inequality might become greater and greater. So to think about that, we need to think about what's our, you know, what's the proper definition of our carbon footprint. So the first measure is, you know, suppose you are driving your electric car on a highway. The first measure of carbon footprint we could use is point of use emission. So this is, are you using, literally, are you emitting while you're driving the car? If it's an electric car, you're not. So that's the first measure. The second measure includes carbon content of electricity usage. So with your electric car, you would emit corresponding to the carbon content of electricity usage. And then the third measure is the total carbon footprint. So I'm going to use total carbon footprint. We could also refer it at consumption carbon footprint, which includes the production of all goods and services that are actually produced to construct the car. So with the car, there is the fact that it has to be constructed at some point. So for example, if you change your old car for a new electric car and you drive the electric car very little, you may have increased your carbon footprint because the car would have been constructed and that would have cost a lot of emission and you were not emitting very much in terms of flow anyway. So it's pretty important to have a notion of that. Of course, it's not available on a person-by-person basis easily. So we can't really get it this way for each person, but we can try to get a sense of how it looked like statistically. So what it looked like not only for countries on average, but for different for people located at different decile of the distribution of income within countries. It requires a bunch of assumptions, so this is to take with a certain amount of caution, like any of this work. But this is work that, in particular, Lucas Chancel has done, first with Thomas Piketty, then with Tancred Voiturier, on the using the combination of amazing inequality data put together by the World Inequality Lab, which have distribution data for large parts of the world, combining that with consumption survey of what people at various level of incomes are consuming, with an elasticity of the energy demand of this consumption level, which is not quite one. So actually, the rich for their consumption, the rich are consuming less per consumption per unit of consumption, but they also consume very much. So on balance, you get a sense of, at each level of income distribution within each country, what is an estimate of people at these deciles of carbon footprint. And once you have that, you can put the whole world together, you can put the world together by country, you can do average by country, whatever you want. Of course, it's based on all this assumption. But you get this pretty striking results in terms of the inequality of contribution to climate change, which is summarized nicely by this 10-50 rule. The 10% highest polluters, which are also the richest people, given the way by construction, given the way it's done, are responsible for almost 50% of global emission, and conversely, the 50% lowest emitters are responsible for 10% of the global emission today. Another thing that the high polluters mainly live in rich countries. And this is actually a map that I didn't take from Chancel's work, although he would have the same amount, the same type of results, but I took it from Bruckner because that's another team applying very different assumptions to the same problem and coming with very similar results, which doesn't mean that either of them is correct, but gives you one more level of comfort. And you get here also a nicely color-coded map of emission by regions with Sub-Saharan Africa contributing nothing to the problem whatsoever, and then the US being very, very red. This is a consumption emission total carbon footprint. And then, as I mentioned from Chancel's work, we also note that even though across countries inequality is big, within country inequality is more and more important over time as consumption globalized, particularly the consumption of the richest percentile of each countries. So in 1990, 62% of the global carbon inequality they estimated is due to a cross country, and by now it's basically reversed with 64% by 2019. What this means is that the sort of trade-off that is lurking around in a lot of policy conversation between eradicating poverty and fighting climate change is really neither here nor there. Because if your level of consumption per capita is less than $2 a day, which is the current poverty line, or $2.15 a day, you're not contributing anything to climate change. If I bring you to 2%, to $2, it's still not going to be very much. The Bruckner estimates, what they do is that they look at various sustainable development goals and they say, how much would that increase carbon emission if we achieve them? And if you achieve the first one of reducing extreme poverty, you would increase emissions by only 2%. So it's really, there shouldn't be a trade-off. The countries that have a lot of very poor citizens need the citizens to grow richer for any number of reasons, including the fact that it's going to make it easier for them to cope with climate change, and we shouldn't have any debate there. But so the other part of it is that this inequality in who contributes to climate change is almost mirrored by the inequality of who suffers from the immediate consequence of climate change. Already today, because climate has already changed, we just experienced the 12 hottest months on Earth in history, but also as we move in our trajectory. Why is that? Well, part of it is bad luck. The poor countries tend to be in places that are already hot today. And although the impact of climate change is not exactly, if it's say the Earth warmth by 2 degrees, it's not going to be 2 degrees everywhere. But on balance, it still means that if a place is already hot, it's going to get hotter from this hot basis, and the impact on climate change on anything, but particularly on human health, are not linear. They are very nonlinear, and in particular, after 35 degrees centigrade is just too hot for human life. And it means these places that are already hot are going to experience more of those days that are hot. So this is by 2050. These places that are already hot are going to experience more of the very hot days. And by 2100, I didn't put the map for 2100, even more so. So you were seeing, you know, the Sahel region of Africa, the just south of the Sahara, the northern part of Brazil, the north of South Asia, are places that are going to experience many more days that are just not good to live, and that are associated with extra mortality. So that's the first problem. That's just mechanical. The other problem is that the ability of people to protect themselves, people and countries to protect themselves from climate change is very related to how much money they have or how much money the country has. Because there are some investments that can be done either publicly or individually. For example, you can have, if you have electricity, if the country is richer, there's more electricity, you can have air conditioning. But you can also decide to not go work when it's very hot, and it's not possible if you're in Pakistan. So the Climate Impact Lab, and in particular a team that involved Michael Greenstone, Tama Carlton, Ishan Nath, and many others, actually, have put together data to quantify these differences. So they have data from 12,000 small regions in the world. This map is a bit misleading because it's extrapolated across the whole world. They don't have the whole world, but they have quite a few regions and a long history. Climate change hasn't happened yet, but what has happened is variation around the normal, the trends, as well as the moving up trend. So in some years, in some regions, it just gets particularly hot. And then what they do is that within a country, for example, they will compare the mortality rate when there is more days that are particularly hot vis-à-vis the benchmark temperature, say, of 20 degrees. So if in one district in India it's particularly hot one year, they are going to compare that the mortality there to another district where it wasn't that hot and vice versa. So we basically exploit the fluctuation in weather around kind of moving average. What this means, by the way, is that those are not the full mortality impact we can expect from climate change, because it doesn't include any catastrophes. This is really kind of business as usual hot days. It doesn't include any of the, you know, tipping point or anything like that. This is basically extrapolating from the past. So I think it's a good way to think about it as a lower bound of what might happen. And so what they look at is that then they estimate this mortality to number of hot days response function, which you have here on the left side of the graph. For countries that are used to, that have had experience with hot climate before, that are the hot countries, and for those who don't, and for countries that are poor and rich. And two things come up very clearly. So the mortality increase from hot temperature is on the right side of the graph, so you see it ticking up. But countries that have that tends to be hot and are rich, it doesn't tick up very much because they have had a lot of experience. They know how to, you know, they know how to deal with it. So think Texas, Saudi Arabia, they're prepared. And then countries that are either not used at all to temperature, if it gets very hot, they get surprised. So a few years ago, there was a huge heat wave in France, and there was a big mortality in Paris because everybody abandoned their grandmother in the house, not because they didn't like them, but because they just didn't know that was a thing. And since then, it hasn't been the case. It is something we can actually learn to deal with. So that's the habit part. But what is striking is that there is also an income gradient in the response. So cold countries that are poor have the hugest spike in mortality. But hot countries that are poor also have a big spike in mortality, because even if you're very used, you know what you're supposed to be doing. What are you going to do? If you're a construction worker in Pakistan, and it's 35 degrees, you know it would be better to sleep in your air-conditioned house during the day, but you don't have air conditioning in your house, then you have to work. So income is a limiting factor. So overall, when you kind of extrapolate from the regions they do have as a function of the income they have plus their experience, you get the map that is there, which tells you how much you would suffer from an increase at 35 degrees. What's the change in mortality at 35 degrees relative to the reference temperature? And the more red it is, the more you suffer. So you can see that, you know, if it got super hot in Russia, that would be in Siberia, that it would be bad for them. They are somewhat poor and they are unused to it. But also the sub-Saharan Africa minus South Africa would also suffer because they are poor. If you put the two together, the fact that these places are hot and will get hot and they will suffer more from the hot days, you get this map, which I was recently at a development economics conference, and I think it came in all of the talks. It's a pretty amazing map in how stark it is. And it's a pretty scary map. It shows that if you're thinking about the mortality, this is not, mind you, all the damage from climate change. Climate change is going to do a whole bunch of damage in your country too. But for mortality per se, extrapolating just the impact of temperature, we are seeing a huge concentration of the damages in Africa and in South Asia, where there are a lot of poor people and it's going to get very hot. And the curve gives you an extent, you know, simulating various possibilities, the IPCC model again and again and again. You're getting kind of an idea. Of course, all of these things have a lot of noise. But the bottom line is quite striking. Another thing you're getting is that, also from this simulation, is that it's not hopeless. There is actually, you don't need to get it perfect, because it's so non, it's the convexity is so big. You would really gain a lot from doing just a bit better. And when you go from the 8.5 scenario to the 4.5 scenario, the mortality declined from an estimating extra just due to temperature 73 people per extra per 100,000. That's about 6 million by 6 million extra deaths by 2100, if we continue with the business as usual scenario, and if we manage to abate part of it, it actually comes down a lot. So it's kind of still, it's very much a choice at this point still. And just comparing the mortality to give you a sense of what it is, 73 extra deaths. This is less than the cardiovascular diseases. This is more than all the deaths from infectious diseases in the world today. This is comparable to cancer. So this is not insignificant. And it is entirely outside the OECD. All of the, because it's not that the OECD, again, won't have people dying because it's hot, but they'll also have fewer people dying because it won't get cold. So on balance, it evens out. And again, this is not the entire damage for climate change, just this piece. So if we focus on just this piece and try to put a number on it, and as economists, we know that we need to be careful with this number, but I think it is helpful to just have something to work with, to communicate. We can kind of put the two pieces together, that we really need to look at consumption emission, not production emission, and we need to look at the damage. Just take the a number that gives you a sense of what's the ton of dollars of damage per ton from loss of life. That's calculated again by the Carlton Greenstone NAT team. How do they do that? They're looking, well, let's take a value of a statistical life. The EPA uses between 7 to 10 billion. Convert it into the value of a year, and then, you know, the eventually we'll all die, but we'll die earlier when it gets very hot, so you lose a number of lives. That has a value. And then you multiply the effect of an extra ton on the temperature times the effect of the temperature on mortality. So the extra ton on temperature is from IPCC. Temperature on mortality is from the maps that I just showed you. Value of a statistical life is made up, but at least commonly made up. and you get that number of 37. And it's made up in a way that this is what we use to decide to build beltways or to close a city during COVID and so on. So it's commonly used. And you get that number, 37 per ton. Now multiply $37 per ton by 14 billion tons, that's the consumption emission of Europe and the US last year, and you get this kind of convenient round number of $500 billion per year. So if we keep with the same emission path, that's the number we should have in mind. Now, the truth is you should have a choose-your-own-adventure kind of things number here. It could be much larger, it could be smaller, but let's just play with that 500 billion numbers. That's a lot. That's more than the entire ODA today. That's 10 times what the US gives away. So it's a lot of money. But maybe it's not that much money. And let me tell you why it's not that much money is because I know where to find it. But it's still much more money than we've been able to generate until now. So as Nick Stern here well knows, we had a commitment of, I'll do this in order. So how to find 500 billion? So first of all, is it going to be easy? You know, we realize it's a problem it's a common problem, and it's a problem where at the moment that we are still contributing, the West is contributing much more. Have we shown great ability to handle this type of issues? And the answer, I would argue, is not very much. So the last example was COVID. COVID hit, and countries, rich countries, were able to borrow vast sums of money to protect their citizens. They spent, on balance, 27% of their GDP in fiscal stimulus measures. The poor country, meanwhile, spent 2% of their much smaller GDP on fiscal stimulus measures. I calculated just for fun that if the US had wanted to allow all of sub-Saharan Africa to reach 27% of their GDP, this would have cost them 10% of their entire COVID spending. So it's not nothing, but they could have increased it by 10%, and then they would have brought the entire continent of Africa to 27% of sub-Saharan African GDP. So it was feasible. There was a small increase in aid flow, but very, very small. And meanwhile, we all know the vaccine story. When we were not giving vaccine, when the vaccine were first developed and rich countries started hoarding it, I was like, at least at a minimum, you want to give the vaccine to show that we can work together. It's an easy problem. But this didn't happen, and that is kind of a sign that it's a bit difficult. John Kerry, who was until recently the ambassador for climate for the US, also clearly laid out the cards. Under no circumstance the US will pay climate reparation. He's talking about the past, and that's fine. I'm not wanting to hold them accountable for the past. But that shows you a little bit the politics that we have to deal with. Of course, despite that, there was a loss and damage fund voted at the COP28. But it was voted precisely with the US emphasis on the, with a clear indication that there would be no obligation from anybody to contribute, despite the fact generosity was overwhelming, and 700 million was put in the fund, and there is all today $700 million in that fund. Much of it is repurposed from other uses anyways. So this has not been very successful. On the one hand, I think it's a political reality that we cannot have obligations. On the other hand, it's a political reality that citizens of rich countries are not prepared to vote to use part of their scarce budget for sending money to poor countries, especially if it's just to compensate them, not to make them do a mitigation project. And in fact, so as this is going back to my Nick Stern comment, Nick Stern managed to extract a promise of spending $100 billion a year in developing countries, in low and middle income countries, for climate. And the OECD is tracking how good we got. And we got pretty good in terms of the amount. In 2021, it's 90, and I think it's even higher now. But a large fraction of it is private money. Most of it is loans, and most of it is mitigation. So of this $100 billion, we're actually sending it in the form of loan to mitigate, which is fine. I mean, it's fine to mitigate in a poor country, but it's just the same, it's the same value to us as if we would have mitigated in our country. So it's not helping. It's just, you know, doing the project elsewhere. So this is really, like, again, another indication that we have not managed to do that. So we need to do better. How to move forward? I have 5 minutes to tell you how to move forward. And that's all I need, really. So my point is that we cannot go do mandatory. We cannot, especially if the size of the liability is unknown, that's very scary. And we cannot do voluntary because that's not working. So what we do need to know is to come up with new sources of revenue that are not exist yet, but that are realistic and that can be attributed immediately to this use. Many people have provided, have had ideas of what to do. I have two. One is which we could use to think about the $500 billion a year that I think we need, or $100 billion. This is various measures that have been proposed. They are good, but I'm going to not talk about them much. I'm going to talk about two that I'm thinking about as, you know, potentially not crazy. One is, as of January, about 40 countries are imposing a minimum tax on corporations, of the biggest multinational corporation, of 15%. 137 countries have signed on to that deal, but it's kind of getting in place slowly. The original proposal was 21%, but it got weathered down to 15. So imagine going from 15 to 21. Maybe it's not crazy because, after all, we managed to get together and get it done. So maybe we can continue on this platform and talk about it and take this extra 6% from multinational corporation. That would raise $291 billion a year, according to the EU tax laboratory at PSE. So that's one. That's about half. For the other half, Gabriel Zucman and the EU tax came up in October with a calculation of how much money you could raise with a 2% wealth tax on the 3,000 richest people in the world. A 2% wealth tax is the equivalent of about 30% income tax on the income from the wealth. So it's not extractive. It's not asking them to pay more than their share. It's just getting, you know, tax, kind of a easier way to tax the income from the wealth. That would raise $214 billion a year. There you go. I have my $500 billion a year if we assign them to this goal. I've been peddling this around for some time. This was going nowhere until the Brazilians came up. And the Brazilians are into it. And they have the presidency of the G20. So they are suddenly gave a whole megaphone to this. That doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. But, you know, it's a piece of conversation that people can talk about, and it's great. And then, you know, maybe something will happen, maybe not next year, maybe not the year after, maybe next year or the year after. But at least the idea that you could do this is kind of not crazy. So there are a number of issues. So first, one question that is asked of is, does it get lost if not everybody does it at the same time? But no, as long as a group of countries does it, that can be a good way. Then there is this issue of, like, maybe citizens will agree to the Gabriel tax, but only if they keep the proceeds. And here, the answer is either multinational or very, very wealthy people, they really make their money in a very globalized way. So it's really nobody's money in reality. So there is no reason for the rich countries to have it just because the rich people happen to live there. And there are rich countries actually in a lot of places. It's actually a fairly popular idea. So Adrien Fabre at CNRS have these papers where they kind of poll a large number of people on different proposals. And people, I'm looking for the global tax on millionaire funding low-income country. Note that they have millionaire. The millionaire are much poorer than the billionaire, so I'm guessing if the question was, and people might think that one day they will become millionaire. So I'm thinking the effort would be even more popular if it was a billionaire. 69% of Americans are okay to touch the millionaire to send the money to low-income country, and 84% of Europeans. So actually, I think this has legs politically, and if it does, then people will vote for it, and if they vote for it, then somehow they'll find a way to make it happen. So I don't think I think it can happen. The last point is how to spend the money once you have raised it, since it's almost done. And that's a huge issue of contention for how to spend the loss and damage fund, which doesn't even have enough money, but still people are discussing it. So the poor country says, it's our money. You owe it to us. So you give it to us, we'll figure it out. The rich country said, no, you're not going to use it well. We have to give it to the World Bank so that they have a commission with sub-commission that are going to use it properly. And somehow that creates like big roadblocks. The thing almost didn't get voted because of that. So I was thinking about how we find a governance for this thing that cuts this problem. And my idea is that, okay, you cannot really, even though it's framed as a compensation for loss of life, it's too late if you are already dead. So we should try and give it to people before they are dead as a way, if possible, for them to not die. And we can trust them to use the money well. There is plenty of research that show that people use the money well if it's given to them. So one thing you could do is to say, well, very simple. We are going to have very simple rules that we agree, which are automatic transfer triggered by weather events to individuals. Today, it's totally possible for every person in the world to be connected to a phone-level bank account or a bank account. So you agree on some rule. If it gets very hot, many hot days, you get money. If it gets, if there is a drought, a flood, etc., you get money. Even better if you can get it in advance, which now we can predict, so you can. And you could spend a lot of money like that. That's layer one. Layer two, same thing, but for communities that may have a kind of collective way of providing adaptation. And the third thing is governments, which at the end of the day are the insurer of last resort for a lot of very poor people and are not able to do it. We saw it during COVID. So take the poorest country, not the middle income country, which can do something, but the poorest country, IDA eligible, and give them also automatic transfer in case of real environmental catastrophe as a reinsurance kind of way, which they cannot afford themselves. That will be enough to spend a bunch of the money. There is also a lot of things we don't know about how to do better than that. For example, to prepare people in advance. There should be research all over the world that is preparing that, and there could be financing for that research, those projects, and then to scale up what works. There just are not so many ideas at the moment. So that's kind of where I would stop. That's how I would spend the money. We need to do this because it's the right thing to do. Because if we don't do it, poor countries are going to stop playing ball with a lot of our projects around the world, geopolitical issues where we might need assistance. And also because without adaptation, there will be no mitigation because the poor countries that need to emit less as well, they also need to survive, and for the moment, these two things are in conflict. So let me stop here, and thank you very much. Looking forward to talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for this wonderfully clear presentation. It's not an easy problem, but if there is somebody who can fix it, that's Esther. And assuming that you fixed it, Shweta is going to tell us how to spend it.
Spend some of it.
Some of it. Oh, yeah. Some, not all of it.
So I think I'll sit here and talk since I don't have slides. Very good evening to all of you. Thank you very much to the London School of Economics, Professor Burgess, for inviting BRAC to share some thoughts at this very exciting LSC Environment Week. So imagine that decision makers in the West or the Global North, supported by a majority of their voting population, actually agree to Professor Duflo's proposal. How do we then spend the money so that people bearing the brunt of this crisis can cope? And make no mistake, that people in communities affected by floods, heat, drought, and salination are already acting. They're not waiting around for us to solve this problem for them. They're making decisions now to protect their lives and livelihoods. They are migrating. They are harvesting water from the monsoons to store potable water during extreme heat. They're trying different types of agricultural practices. They're reborrowing to restart the enterprises because they lost what they had built due to an extreme weather event. They're calibrating their risks and acting with the limited resources they have. How can we then, the global community of researchers, civil society, donors and philanthropists, governments, community organizations, grassroots leaders, and affected populations, particularly women, work together to respond to this crisis? We now know that 4 out of 5 people displaced by climate change are women and girls. Climate change threatens all aspects of life, but particularly women and girls, because it affects food security, water access to livelihoods, homes, and psychological well-being. Women and children are 14 times more likely to die than men from extreme weather events, which are increasing in number, as we all know. By 2030, 80 million people globally are predicted to lose their jobs because of heat stress. Female-headed households and households in poverty will bear the greatest loss of income. For every degree above 25 degrees centigrade, household productivity decreases by 2%, which means reduced income for home-based enterprises, more common for women in poverty. So how can we enable the most vulnerable to climate shocks to build resilience and change the trajectory of this crisis? When we talk to people affected by climate change in South Asia, their point of entry is not our point of entry, emissions or guilt. Often their point of entry into this conversation is loss of working hours, its livelihoods. Garmi itni badh gayi ki ghar pe kaam hi nahi ho pata. It became too hot for me to work even at home. Take another example. Chanda Didi in India, who graduated successfully out of poverty because of Bihar government's inclusive livelihood program, which JPL is also supporting, told us that it was so hot for so long last year that her egg vending business, which she started with support from the program, didn't earn a profit for 2 months. We hear similar stories of loss from across South Asia. My goat's children did not survive the drought and heat last summer. It was too hot, even in the forest and under the trees, for us to forage for over a month. These are people who cannot afford to lose work, and these are people whose per capita emissions are mostly below 110 of CO2 per year, and on average, only 0.4 tons. Every working day lost means one less meal, less access to school for children, and less income for healthcare. Loss in productivity means turning back the clock on recent progress we've made on fighting poverty. We at BRAC have come to understand that adaptation must happen at 3 levels: adapting households, adapting communities, and adapting countries and regions. So I'm going to propose 4 sets of solutions to Professor Duflo's tax spending. Let us take the first subset and call it planning. Many governments have formulated heat action plans, disaster response plans, flood responses. These are vital because they provide guidance on how to respond during an extreme weather event. But we also need to now develop adaptation plans that are preemptive and account for loss of livelihoods and income over a longer period of time. These plans need to be developed community by community, city by city, addressing specific needs and vulnerabilities. There's no one-size-fits-all. BRAC in Bangladesh has developed ward-level adaptation plans which feed into city-level plans. We are also working with the government of Bihar to develop ward and city-level plans. These plans are ideally created by community institutions with support from NGOs and city government staff. They are intended to make slum housing more resilient to heat and water stress, for example, by applying solar reflective white paint on roofs that bring down temperatures by 3 degrees and are cheap to implement. 5 liters of solar reflective paint costs $19. Organizations like Mahila Housing Trust in Ahmedabad, Gujarat, are already working to implement this in low-income settlements. These adaptation plans have to anticipate climate migrants who will escape to cities, which is already happening across South Asia. Though we cannot anticipate and predict every extreme weather event at a national level, if community collectives and institutions are prepared, solutions will find ownership. Take, for example, the state of Orissa. They've been working on a community-managed system of cyclone preparedness and have successfully evacuated millions of people from their coastline during the cyclones of 2013 and 2019. This is because self-help groups and village organizations worked with the government, creating a cadre of 100,000 volunteers that were involved in preparing plans, carrying out drills, and making sure that resilient infrastructure was created, making the success possible. Adaptation measures will only succeed if local communities are empowered to face this crisis. Let's go to the next set of livelihood of adaptation interventions that can absorb this climate tax. And these are investing in already existing poverty, livelihoods, and social protection programs. For example, India has a large livelihood program with a network of 100 million households who form village-level organizations. There are cadres of community resource persons who support these households with enterprise development, links to government social scheme. We need to cultivate these very cadres on climate resource persons. Coaches and graduation programs in Bangladesh and India who support participants through a two-year program cycle are now being trained to talk about coping mechanisms for climate-related shocks and stress. For example, if a household chooses livestock, then how do we protect the chicks if they're born during a heat wave? Coaching modules need to embed curricula that help households and communities prepare for extreme weather events. Each livelihood option needs to be climate-proofed. Small infrastructural investments like cool animal shelters or cooling chambers that can keep produce fresh without any energy input will help. Organizations like RuCart in India, with the help of from IIT Bombay, has developed a sabzi cooler that costs $360 and runs on 20 liters of water a day. Similarly, Cool Crop from Gujarat are offering communal refrigeration through solar-powered micro-cold storage units and are working with Aga Khan Foundation to get this facility to farmers. Such innovations need more investment. Graduation-inspired livelihood programs in Bihar and in India and graduation program in Bangladesh are incorporating climate-adaptive measures, even though it means a slight increase in costs, up to $200 to $300 per participant. Professor Bendiera will be sharing a study on exactly that facet of graduation. This then brings me to the third set of solutions. This is around financial assistance, either via cash transfer or financial products like insurance. Usually, cash transfers are provided after a shock hits. With more sophisticated early warning systems, especially for cyclones, it might be possible to provide preemptive cash transfers. In India, SEVA and separately Mahila Housing Trust are piloting parametric insurance during heat waves for women employed in waste management, street vending, and construction. If certain levels of meteorological triggers are met, like day and night temperatures and humidity levels, then an automatic payment is made into the worker's bank account so that she does not have to risk her life for the day on that day. But at the moment, these products are being underwritten by private players and are in pilot mode. If we need to get these products to millions of people, then we need some form of public sector underwriting. Should the tax base of adapting countries be underwriting such insurance, or could some of this climate tax be channeled towards guarantees and innovation in the financial sector? The final contender for the climate tax, which brings me to the fourth and final set of solutions, is learning and cross-regional cooperation. Government machinery, their ability to mobilize resources and personnel, enable policies and guarantees will, of course, be crucial. They are already responding. The Ministry of Rural Development India has just set up a climate cell that is supposed to oversee climate resilience amongst the livelihood programs across India. civil society, private sector trying to innovate. Catalytic funding, investment in skills and learning will be important. But we need to reimagine how this coalition can come together within countries and interregionally. Currently, diplomatic and interregional cooperation is structured for trade, commerce, natural resource sharing, and peace initiatives. Climate adaptation requires a new way of learning, talking, and sharing so communities, civil society, and governments can learn from each other across vulnerable corridors that often don't align with national boundaries. Just this last month, West Bengal and Orissa were as affected by heat waves as Bangladesh. We must co-create and refine solutions together, and we cannot rely only on LSE's Environment Week, as amazing as it is to make that dialogue happen. Finally, the language of global development is primarily Anglophone. We need to listen to how climate stress is being discussed in vernacular languages. We listen to economists a fair amount, but we also need to listen to environmental historians, anthropologists, architects, geographers, grassroots leaders. There were solutions in the past that we can bring to life now. Pradhan is restoring 13th century water tanks in the district of Tamil Nadu to increase groundwater levels. This climate tax can create more research and implementation capacity on adaptation in the global south, within universities there, closer to the crisis. And we need to look beyond the university system. Adaptation schools that can create well-trained cadres of resource persons who live and work in diverse locations. Such schools are needed not only in the cities of Nairobi, Mumbai, and Chittagong, but also in forest, rural, and coastal areas. To close, unlike my stellar fellow panelists, I cannot stun you with any numerical or analytical abilities, but I can leave you with some poetry. This is a short verse by one of South Asia's beloved poets, Rabindranath Tagore, and he was also a favorite of BRAC's founder, Fazle Hasan Abed. The night is black and the forest has no end. A million people thread it in a million ways. We have trysts to keep in the darkness, but where or with whom, of that we are unaware. But we have this faith that the lifetime's bliss will appear any minute with a smile upon its lips. Thank you again, and let us thread light through this forest of darkness together.
Okay, so after poetry, you are supposed to be listening to Standard Errors. I don't know how. I'm gonna make it. So I'll be fast because it's late and you all want to ask questions, but I wanted to present some numbers, at least. There'll be no standard errors, it's too late, on how this program, the graduation program, which holds great promise in reducing poverty, is affected by climate change and how the program itself can affect the resilience of beneficiaries to climate change. So we have shown, Esther has shown, we have shown, other researchers have shown that the program, the graduation program, can be very effective. For all those of you who do not know what the graduation program is, in essence, it's a program that believes that poor people are poor by chance, and that given the right opportunities, they can make their own livelihoods. It's a revolutionary idea, I know, it works. It's amazing. You give people enough to start a business, they start a business. They do not like to be poor. So it does work quite well. The problem is it works in levels. Does it work against shocks? So that's the first question that we're going to ask today. And the second question is, does climate change perhaps mute the effect of the graduation program? The answer, strangely, to both questions is yes. So if you fall asleep once I show you the numbers, you already know what we're going to find. And how is that possible? Well, how do the graduation program work? It's through incentives and enabling the poor to invest in livelihood activities. So you start with somebody who has absolutely nothing, who works as a maid for some rich landowner. You gave them a cow. You explained them how to take care of the cow. You give them social assistance. You give them financial assistance. Within 4 years, they have a flourishing business. Now, investment is at the heart of the graduation program. And we know that climate change increases uncertainty, and uncertainty is the number one enemy of investment. On the other hand, they've received the program, they are richer. So does wealth make you more resilient? As an anecdote, the founder of BRAC, Sir Abed, supposedly founded BRAC because he visited Bangladesh during a flood in 1972, I think. And he concluded that it wasn't the flood killing people, it was poverty. So that if he could take people out of poverty, there wouldn't be any more death. Of course, in 1972, he wasn't predicting the floods that we have nowadays. So this is what we do. There is a wonderful website, which is the World Flood Database, that contains information on every flood happening every day for the last 20 years. So we have maps like this that tell us where the floods happened. What we do is that we impose a grid on the map, and we put our villages, the villages where we have data on the ultra poor program, in that grid. And then we overlay the data from the flood database, and we calculate which percentage of the village is flooded on any given day. These grids here are 250 meters by 250 meters. It's extraordinary what you can do with data today. We do the same thing with the Vegetation Health Index from the FAO to calculate the risk of drought. Somewhat surprisingly, in the same places, you can have floods and droughts in the same year. You can be that lucky. So you put all of this together and you get a combined climate shock index. So now that we have this measure, we can go and see whether in villages where there are more shocks, the program protects people or not. Now, it is important to decompose the shocks in what can be predicted and what cannot be predicted. As Esther was saying earlier, countries or areas of a country which are used to shocks have developed systems to cope with them. So we look at the average climate shocks that happened before the program was implemented. The program implementation started in 2007. We look at the history of shocks before then, and then we look at the surprise element. And the surprise can be of two types. You can get more than expected, so you expect the village to be flooded half the way, it gets flooded completely, or you get it at the wrong time. So you were expecting the flood in March, you were all ready for the flood, and nothing happened, and then in the middle of November, the flood came. Right? We ignore that part. So the first, it just slipped in there. The first results that I'm going to show you is the effect of the surprise shock, okay? Right, that's consumption. We have two bars in there, a red bar and a blue bar. You can barely see the blue bar. The blue bar is treatment villages. So ultra-poor people treated by the program do not suffer consumption losses when a surprise shock hits. The red bars are the control villages. So equally poor people in control villages who haven't been given the program suffer losses of consumption when the shock hits. If you want to know whether that's big or small, roughly it corresponds to a drop in consumption of 3%, well, it depends whether you look at food consumption or total consumption. For food consumption is 4% for one extra day of floods. Okay? One more day of floods that you didn't expect, consumption drops 4%. And these are people who already consume fairly little. Same thing with assets. The effect is actually much stronger. You lose about 15% of assets for each extra day that there is a flood. The blue bars are there, but they're basically zero. And this comes with a change in the use of labor, which was the whole point of the program, was to make sure that the poor got more productive occupations. The shock, given that you lose the assets, brings you back from livestock rearing, which is a productive occupation, to casual labor, which is the worst thing that you can do. However, there is also an adaptation element, because the places that have more shocks today have had more shocks in the past. And so we do find evidence, and this is the last graph with standard error that I'll show you, that in villages where there are shocks in the past, people invest less. Beneficiaries of the ultra-poor program have a lower level of investment, especially at low quantiles, which means that those who would have invested little, if they live in an area which is prone to shocks, invest even less. So this means that the program, in order to achieve the same impact, it has to give more. Unless, and this is the fundamental point, we can think of weather-specific insurance. As Fredo was saying, insurance is essential at this point. And this is insurance without moral hazard, because you do not control whether you're going to have a drought or a flood. The usual argument against giving insurance is that it's not sustainable because people cheat. We do lots of things, you know, lots of good opportunities are missed because of this belief that people cheat. And there is very little evidence that they do. But in this case, they really can't, because you can't make up a flood. So if the insurance is linked to a flood index, the ultra-poor program, the graduation program, can continue reducing poverty. But if we wait too long, people will adapt to a point that they will always be reluctant to invest, and then there's no taking them out of poverty. So I leave you with these numbers, and I open the floor for questions. You have Tim? Ah, there you are, Tim.
So we have more questions than time, so I will choose three short questions that came from online. Number one, and this is to everyone on the panel. Number one, what extra considerations need to be made for small island states with respect to climate change? Number two, should large emitting emerging economies like China and India also pay into a loss and damage fund? Good luck. Number three, should rich countries compensate developing countries for keeping unexploited fossil fuels in the ground?
You wanna,
Professor?
Am I still wired? I've lost the middle question. What was the middle question?
India and China.
Oh, yes. Note that the billionaire tax is and the tax on multinational corporations is not geography dependent. I think it's very helpful. It's not about where you live. It's about what you consume. And also the extent for corporation that you make profit out of everybody's consumption. So in some sense, that's a question you don't need to ask. That's actually an attraction of spending, of raising money this way. However, there is a flip side of the question that people often ask me is, should money go to China and India? Because after all, they are not. And there, my own view is that it should go, again, it should go to people who are poor. Wherever that happens to be, and India has plenty of poor people who are very affected by climate change. And one could go maybe beyond the national level, go at a subnational level. And in the end, India is billionaire and they are very, very poor people. So at some level, it can, you know, maybe from an India point of view, it will kind of wash out. So that's one. The compensation for keeping fossil fuel. So I didn't go there at all because I didn't. I'm kind of disconnecting this from mitigation, and I think it's a mitigation question. Because a ton of carbon is a ton of carbon. Ideally, everyone should face the same cost if you put a ton of carbon in the atmosphere, but then that has huge distributional effect that needs to be compensated somehow. And one of the way to compensate them is, in fact, start people with a grant that is taken away as they start to emit, country. So that maybe that has a flavor of that. But it's kind of neither here nor there from the point of view of this particular discussion today, although I think in reality it's a very important discussion to have. The island state, I think, is kind of go to this discussion. It's kind of an extreme version of the discussion that Shweta had about. This is all the ultra poor program. The cash transfer I was discussing are kind of good about the kind of high frequency impact, but doesn't tell us much about adaptation, which is when the weather pattern has changed for good. Livelihood need to change for good, and then I think we know even less about that's true adaptation in a way. So for island state, as an extreme version of that, that they might not even be there anymore. But at a less extreme version, we also saw that of people, you know, in Niger, for example, said, you know, you can't grow like anything where you used to be able to grow things. It's not something that we fully know even how to think about, let alone about how to construct rules that are automatic, simple, clear, that everybody can agree to send the money. But this is the part that would go into the research pot that Shweta also highlighted.
There was one there in the back.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So my question is, consequence of climate change is often health, and health is often synonymous to poverty by virtue of out-of-pocket expenditure or loss in productivity. However, health is not being mainstreamed enough in climate conversations. So how can we bridge that gap?
Thank you. There's one in the middle. And there you are, sorry.
Hi, I'm Francisca. I'm also an MPP student. Sorry for monopolizing the word. So I have one for Professor Duflo, and it's you talked about these individual cash transfers, and I wonder what are the differences, or if there, or if we could translate that into UBI. And if that would be even like a more effective way of tackling events that we cannot predict and kind of like play around uncertainty. And also to Shweta, sorry if I mispronounced it, how can we tackle and counteract the narrative between, because in Latin America there's lots of conversations and also like even a consultation from the highest court about the intersection of human rights and climate change. And one of the things is participation, the principle as a principle. And some people kind of like reject that narrative, saying like, if we ask people to participate in things that are urgent, we might lose time. So how can we just engage with this narrative about efficiency? Like, if we ask people first, we might be more efficient, or like, what kind of narrative you would propose to that?
Thank you. And here in front.
Thank you so much. My name is Stephanie. I'm from Peru, and I do research on the impact of the mining industry. First, I'll start with a statement. I remember reading that people in richer countries consume, on average, 13 times more than people in low-income countries. Now, most of the comforts of people who live in richer countries are somehow linked to extractive industries, which have a long precedent of human rights abuses and environmental damage in low and middle income countries. So although I think it's these development projects that focus on alleviating the effects of climate change, I think they're fascinating, and of course they're helping many people. I think there's something about focusing on that instead of somehow curbing consumption in richer countries that still doesn't sit well with me. I know it's perhaps not a feasible, it's not feasible, it's not a realistic statement, but I'm curious to know what's your take on this issue, on this dilemma. Thank you.
If you want to start, Gustav, take turn.
Yeah, on the question of health, Krantika's question, I mean, I think people who are affected by climate stress at the moment talk about it in terms of livelihoods and health. Maybe the conversation at a higher level, we miss out on that. But definitely, it's about, you know, heat exposure, you know, getting dehydrated, you know, dizziness, you know, the malaria after the flood. I mean, people remember these things by that. They talk about them all the time. In terms of response, I think you're absolutely right. I think we need to look at, so for example, para health workers, ASHA workers in India can be, you know, trained also in climate responsive you know, modules. So we need to think more creatively about expanding you know, health responses post extreme weather event. The second question was, do we lose efficiency via being participatory? I think that was your question. And the answer is, even if we lose efficiency, at least what we will prepare or build will work and, you know, will be serving those that we intended to serve. So I think it's one, I mean, efficiency, I know I'm talking to economists, but efficiency is okay, should not be the only thing that we should aim for.
Adding on a few of these things, so the universal basic income, it has to be very basic to be universal. So in a sense, this proposal of sending cash transfer that are triggered by weather specific events, that's a way of making this particular proposal work. Insurance doesn't work for any number of reasons. People don't buy it. So that's, as Shweta said, it should be underwritten by, you know, for example, by this tax. I think it should just be paid for by this. It's just so much simpler. In any case, there is a duty of redistribution, and so that's a way of doing it. But you can give much more money if you give it when people really need it. And in particular, if you can do it in an anticipatory way, which we are getting better and better at doing, you can even, you know, people can really, it can really make a difference between loss of life and livelihood. So in that sense, it has some of the flavor of UBI. In a sense, you don't ask questions, you don't waste time, figure out whether you're really eligible, and does your grandmother own a house that would mean that you don't qualify, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, you use the trigger to, that means more money for people who really need it when they need it. And then you can be less stressed about potentially reaching the wrong people and so on. On the your waste time wasting. So first of all, some who is there in the back has been pursuing that community management of forests, for example, is at least as efficient as in terms of protecting the forest, which should be the objective, as state management. So I don't think there is so many evidence that you're wasting so much time by asking people and having them participate. Secondly, is you can do the two things together. I think cash transfer, we know enough that it's really helpful. We can do it now. There is no reason to wait. I don't think people will disagree of getting universal cash transfer in their village when something goes wrong. And then you kind of, you have a basic level of security achieved. From then on, we can do better. And for that, there is so much we don't know for true adaptation that we can kind of start the research, talk to people, and so on. So maybe there is a combination of the two that can be done. On curbing, so I'll give you a number that's a bit more extreme than the one you have in mind. So still according to the Chancel data, an American in the top 10% of the income distribution emits 122 times as much carbon as an African in the bottom 50% of the income distribution. So let me not disagree with you. That's a kind of definitely a good starting point. However, and again, none of what we talked about there is a big elephant in the room, which is the mitigation problem. It's not that it should, that we don't think it's important, but the two maybe needs to move together. And we had a discussion this afternoon about, do we have better technology so we can continue to consume what we always consume, but in a less damaging way, or do we think about consumption decline? Everybody can decide where they are placed on that scale. I don't think consumption decline for very rich people is crazy, I don't think the tax I'm proposing that I'm proposing spending on this is any big enough to lead to consumption decline. But at least it's progressive. One thing that you could envision doing. Having a carbon tax flavor to the multinational corporation tax by giving people rebates for true good carbon footprint.
Thank you so much. We're already over time, unfortunately. Sorry. Plenty of food for thought, and let not be the better be the enemy of the good. Let's start acting now. Thank you, Esther. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.